At this, the first anniversary meeting, it is indeed my distinct pleasure and privilege to welcome an out-of-town speaker whom we're all anxious to hear from. Holly has traveled some considerable distance from Detroit, and I know that we are all looking forward to her message. It is therefore with much happiness that I introduce to all of us Holly M. of Detroit, Michigan.
As I stand here before you this morning, something came to my mind that was sent to me a month ago. And it came to me at this particular time because it seemed so real. You don't have to tell how you live each day. You don't have to tell if you work or play. You don't have to tell if for others you live. Not for what you can get, but for what you can give. And if you live close to God's infinite grace, you don't have to tell it. It shows in your face. And I have seen that, and I see that here this morning. Now, we all know why we are here this morning. We are here because someone, somewhere, at some time or other, spoke our language, regardless of what that language was. It reminds me so much of a little story that I heard many years prior to coming into AA, of a little fellow that was quite incorrigible, and he lived on the opposite side of the track with his mother. He's a very, very stubborn youngster. And his mother had taken him downtown one day, and she said, "Now, son, please don't ask for anything because I have no money." He immediately got in the toy department, and he fell in love with a little wagon. She said, "Now, son, you have to get out of there. I don't have any money to buy it." And he just simply sat right there. And the store manager came over, and he says, "Oh, madam, don't be alarmed." He says, "I can get him out. We have a child psychiatrist on the floor, and he understands children." So the psychiatrist came over, pardon me if there's any in the audience, and he handed the child such gibberish as a psychiatrist can hand one, and the child simply sat there. In the meantime, a clergyman walked up, and he says, "Oh, I can get him out." He says, "Now, my dear boy, if you don't get out of that wagon, the bad man's going to get you." All the time, his mother's still praying, and he still sits right there. He ignores the clergyman. Then there is a physician on the floor, and he came over, and he said, "Now, son, if you don't get out of that wagon, you're going to die. It's been sprayed with a deadly chemical." And he simply sat right there. It meant nothing. Now, in the meantime, there was a lowly, illiterate janitor on the floor who saw the commotion, and he came over. And he says, "I understand that child. I live on the same street he does, and I speak his language, and I can get him out." And they thought, "Now, here are three men a letter. What can this illiterate janitor do?" He said, "Well, let me try," which he did. So he leaned over and he whispered something in the child's ear, and immediately the child got up out of the wagon and took his mother by the hand and went quietly out of the door. So they said, "Now, what did you say to him?" He said, "I told you I speak his language." He said, "Well, please tell me what you said." He said, "I told him, if you don't get the hell out of that wagon, I'll break every damn bone in your body." He couldn't put the car's language, you know. But you see, it wasn't until I found someone that spoke my language that is what brought me here today. Even today, sometimes when I am talking with the non-alcoholic, I am still on the defensive. I am still reminding myself all the time, "Holly, watch your step." I remember not too long ago, I was coming down the street, and I ran into an old lady. She had two large bundles of groceries, and she seemed quite worn out, and I took one of them, and I walked her to her porch, and I sat them down. She says, "Oh, thank you, darling." She says, "It's a wonderful girl, such a nice young woman in the neighborhood." She says, "I hope I run into you someday when you're loaded." I said, "Oh, no, you don't, madam." I still have to constantly watch as well as pray, because the tempter is always, my dear, right there. Now let's go back again a bit. Now, why is it that three very learned gentlemen could not help this child. Well, I'll tell you why. I met these same three austere gentlemen on my road to Jericho. The minister told me where I wasn't going to go. The psychiatrist told me where I needed to go. And due to the inadequacy of my purse, the good doctor told me where I could go. But you see, when you are young and fairly decent looking, that's been many years ago, no one ever tells you then, especially if you got a buck, that you shouldn't drink. See, they always tell you, darling, you shouldn't drink so much. Or, darling, you're too intelligent to drink. And along will come the boys, and they'll tell you, now, dear, if you loved me, you wouldn't drink. How corny can you get? See, one of those things, see. And, you know, when you're young and you're fairly decent looking, there's always the old doll, you know, that takes the young doll along to show her the ropes how to get a drink. You see, the old doll wants to continue her drinking, see, and she knows that if she takes the young doll along into a beer garden, that no gentleman is going to walk in and buy the young doll a drink without buying the old doll a drink. Now, you see, the reason why I know this, I've played on both leagues, see. To cover my drinking, see. And I had quite a, shall I say, a career of it. It lasted 27 years. Now, due to the lateness of the hour, and because I do feel that too much qualifying at times is really beyond the, shall we say, the boundary of propriety. It isn't necessary. I certainly wouldn't have rode that iron booby trap all the way over here in the coal just to show off. No, no. This, to me, is a privilege, and I'm indeed grateful to you for inviting me. See? These 27 years that I speak of, I didn't stay drunk every day. I was not a binge drinker, though, by no stretch of your imagination. But now the longest period of sobriety that I can remember at one time was 40 days during Lent. Before Lent was over, I despised the Pope, the Bishop, the Priest, the Nuns, and all the altar boys. See? And then furthermore, the Cardinal didn't write me a letter. So I got angry. When the clock got on 12, I had a beer can opener in my hand. Now, I had heard about AA 6 or 7 years prior to my coming into this fellowship. You see, in spite of all of his greatness and all of his goodness, Almighty God is still a gentleman. He doesn't go where he isn't wanted. That is for sure. I can remember sitting one night in my kitchen, and the radio came on, and over it was the story called The Glass Crutch. It was a story about a woman that had a drinking problem. Now, I don't remember any of the intimate details of the story, but I do remember that it was about a woman that had a drinking problem. By this time, my friends, I was a complete wino in every sense of the word. Well, I felt like this. Now, if that dame would just quit drinking whiskey and drink wine, well, she wouldn't need that thing. Molly Pitcher was the only woman I ever worked for all day long, and she whipped me every night, see. But nevertheless, I loved her very dearly. Now, when I first heard this story, I thought, I'll never meet that. But Almighty God is very subtle. This story would come back to my mind, shall we say, once a year, then twice a year, and then every 3 or 4 months, and then it began to be very repetitious, coming back, back, back. These were the words that I would hear as I would walk down the street. The heel plates on my shoes would beat out the word, the glass crutch, the glass crutch. I can remember sitting in the house and the clock on the wall, it didn't say tick-tock, it said the glass crutch, the glass crutch. I can remember sitting in my living room, and I had a newspaper in my hand, I was trying to read, and it seemed like that very day that every word on that paper read the glass crutch. It was then that, and only then, that my eyes fell from the paper on my hand, and it dawned on me what these words meant, the glass crutch. Holly, you can't even read a newspaper without a glass of alcohol in your hands. Well, I would like to tell you that I dropped the glass in the paper and ran madly to the phone, but I did no such thing. Because I felt I can lick this. You know, one of those things, I'm master of all I survey, you know, one of those things, but it wasn't like that. So finally, just about, this is the drunk that I want to always remember, the 3 weeks prior to my coming into this wonderful fellowship, that I became just like a zombie. It was only then that I called that number, see. And shall I say, over these past few years that I have been in AA, every one of them has been a very happy day? No. But the worst day that I've had in AA is 100% better than the best day I had out there drinking. That is for sure. Now, when I first came into the fellowship, anything anybody told me to do, I did it. For this reason. My children were unmanageable, my neighbors were unmanageable, the store manager was unmanageable, everybody was unmanageable. And I thought, I can get these guys straight, but I don't have to stop drinking. And I learned that Holly Martin's life was unmanageable. That's the life it was. Now, to tell you that, oh yes, I caught on right away, oh no. You see, they said keep it simple. If they'd have said keep it stupid, I'd have got it right away. But they said keep it simple. So I had to keep coming back, reading these 12 steps over and over, reading chapter 5 over and over. So finally one day, one word broke through to me, that word we. And it meant a tremendous amount to me. We. The first word of the program. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. You see, then I knew at last I belonged someplace in this world. I was no longer that woman down the street with them two doggone bad brats. See? Oh, from time to time, yes, I had tried to straighten up. That's very, very true. Those times that I would try to go to PTA meetings and be a good mother and all that sort of thing, but I would undoubtedly say or do the wrong thing. And here my kids would have to come back home and tell me about it, you know. Now, all while I was drinking, they thought I was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful mother. Why? Because they got everything under the sun that I could beg, steal, or borrow. Was it because of my great undying love for them? No. It was a sense of guilt and remorse. That was why. And furthermore, you know, when you got a hangover, you don't hit a kid anyway. You give him a quarter and send him to the show. You can't stand that noise. See? One of those things. I was the type of mother, if you woke up in the morning and you said you wanted popsicles for breakfast, you got popsicles because you didn't have to cook popsicles. Always the easiest way out, so therefore they loved me. But you see, as time went on, and children began to know what respect and love is, it's kind of hard to do that, you know. Especially when your mother wants to sing all night long in the yard and all those sort of things. Well, she comes down the street and she swears at the neighbors if they're looking out at her, if they got the shades pulled down, she swears at them and calls them a bunch of cowards. That isn't very pleasant then, is it? No, my friends, it isn't. But then, coming into this fellowship changed quite a few of those things because of that first word. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, say. And I began to understand that it wasn't the other people's lives that was unmanageable, it was mine that was unmanageable. You see, my friends, loneliness has caused more mischief than poverty ever dreamed of. And I was indeed a very lonely person. Any of us that have drunk that way, any man or woman that drinks that way today is still a very lonely person. You see, that loneliness comes from this. The people that don't drink at all certainly don't want to be bothered with you. The people that are so-called social drinkers, they don't want to be bothered with you, see. And there's nothing on earth more spickable than someone that's drunker than you are, see. So it's like this. You see, people were sick of me long before I was sick of myself. It was only until I was thoroughly sick of me that I was ready to do something about this illness of mine. See, through that word, we, I didn't have to do it alone. See, I have great admiration for the loner. But I say, you see, misery loves company, and I was a very miserable person when I came in this program, see. I always like to impress upon new people, if there's any questions when you go to your meeting that you want to ask, don't be shy or ashamed, because there may be someone sitting right next to you that's just as shy or ashamed as you are. Because I do believe in my first meeting I asked about the silliest question anybody could ask, but I got a good answer. Someone said to me, Do you have any questions you want to ask? I said, yes, you mean to tell me if I keep coming here, all those little things that I see around the house will go away? And one of the gentlemen says, I think she's had DTs. And another says, no, I believe it's just hallucinations. I said, look, gentlemen, I'm paying rent for something besides me and the kids. I wish it would go away. One of those things. So I continue to come there. And in the first phase of this program, when I found out what real sobriety meant, real sobriety. You see, when someone told me in the very beginning, this person has been sober 6 weeks, well, I could buy that. 6 months, I was a little dubious. 6 years, he's a damn liar. Nobody says that. But my friends, it works. It works for this particular reason that I have found out. See, as long as I do not take credit for my sobriety, it will work for me. It is just like Peter when he walked on the water. As long as he kept his eyes on the master, he walked. But immediately he began to look at his feet, he began to flounder, because he says, I'm walking. So therefore, ladies and gentlemen, it's necessary that I keep my eyes on the master. You see, the big book tells us, remember, you deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there's one that has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. The big book tells me that. Almighty God says, without me, you can do nothing. So it was necessary that I came to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. Now, just what kind of sanity? This kind of sanity, my friends. The kind of sanity that tells me this. Any time, any person, place, or thing is so important that I must take a drink for, then that person, place, or thing has become a power greater than me. You see, there was never a time in my life that any person, place, or thing was so important that I stopped drinking for them. No. There was no bartender that ever threw me out of a bar that I ever stopped drinking because of that. So, my friends, today there can be no person, place, or thing that is so important that I should take a drink for. No. God gave me this. You aided me and you helped me, but God restored me to sanity. And for me, because of some person, place, or thing to reach out and take a drink, I have spit in the face of Almighty God. And may that never happen. Only God can restore me to sanity. Now, to me, this second step they told me when I came into the program, you will find something that will open the key, that will open the door. You will find a key that will open the door. And it was this second step, my friends. Sometimes when I'm at home and my friends tell me, oh, Holly, you get carried away with that second step. I said, I'd rather get carried away than I would get put away, that's for sure. So I better hold on to it. I find that. So therefore, when I have found something that can restore me to sanity, then I am offered one of the greatest privileges that was ever endowed to mankind, and that is the third step, to make a decision to turn my life and my will over to his keeping. That, to me, my friends, is indeed a privilege, because I have, again, free will. John Barleycorn doesn't rule my life. I'm given free will to make this decision. The thing that I love about this third step, it makes me realize that this program goes one step further than the greatest love story that was ever told, the story of Ruth and Naomi. It says this to me, whither thou goest, I shall go. Whither thou lodgest, I shall lodge. Thy people shall be my people. But here's where it goes one step further. It doesn't say that your God has to be my God. It says God as I understand him. It matters not whether it's a Jew going quietly in and out of his synagogue, or whether it's a Protestant with his voice raised in song, or whether it's a Catholic on bended knee receiving the Holy Eucharist at the anointed hands of the priest. It's God as he understands him, not some God that someone else wants to push down our throats. And that third step, humanity, is united with divinity. So therefore, ladies and gentlemen, that is indeed a privilege, because I become an instrument in the hands of God. Each day when I take that third step, which I must do many times a day, that is my covenant with Almighty God. So now when I have sanity and I have sobriety, these are the things that I want to hold on to. And how can I hold on to them? The fourth step tells me how I can. It tells me this, that I make a searching and fearless moral inventory. And why is that necessary? Because I want peace. And where is peace? Dante has said, our peace is in his will. St. Augustine has said, peace is the tranquility of order. So in order to have peace and order, I must look in and see the things that would shut that out. I must go back and remember the things that I was taught even as a child. I've been restored to sanity. I can think. I can remember as a child I was taught always, day in and day out, avoid the near occasion of that first sin. But that meant nothing to me in those days. It went in one ear and out the other. But I have learned how to apply it in this program. Avoid the near occasion of that first drink. So how can I do that? By taking this searching and fearless small inventory. Sometimes I like to even elaborate a little on that fourth step. You know, when we've been in the program a little while, and your corns don't hurt you so bad, and you feel pretty good, you know, and you look in the mirror and you say, oh, yes, you know, you seem to forget that you're not the same Don Juan or Theta Bell that you once thought you were. So therefore, I have to sometimes, when I say elaborate on that step, I have to take a little physical inventory. And I'd like to pass it on to you how I do that. In the morning, my friends, when you first get up, after you've removed your night clothes, leave your teeth laying on the dresser. Now put your eyeglasses on and stand back and survey the wreckage. You will find out you are not the same Don Juan that you thought that you were. See? You say sometimes, oh, I know, I could go into the beer garden now and everybody would be tickled to death to buy me a drink. But when you see that wreckage, it'll be all you can do to keep them buying your own self one. So we make this searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. You know, sometimes I think we take, I'm sure that we do, at least I did, two inventories. Sometimes when we hear a speaker talk, we say, well, you know, I don't know yet, I'm not convinced yet. Whether or not that I need this program after all. I didn't drink quite that much, you know, so I don't know about that. Well, you know, even the master has said this. It's not what goes into a man's mouth that causes him to become unclean, but what comes out of it, which tells me this. It doesn't matter how little or how much I drank. It's what it made me do. It's the unclean things that I did. That's the way, my friends, that I must look at that. And then on the other hand, we might say, well, look, I don't think I need that. I never went to jail. My friends, I never was put in jail either. Not the kind that they have out there. But self-imprisonment is the worst imprisonment there is. Especially, my friends, when every bar of your jail is fear, and the walls are lined with self-pity, and the lock is pride, and no one can open it but you, and the key is honesty, and you've lost it. And we know that this lock unfastens from the inside. So that's why we come here, to find that key. And breaking through that lock of pride is a tremendous job, because it has to be unfastened many, many times. Once we get it unfastened and we free ourselves through this fellowship, we begin to examine this thing. So therefore, we become ready for Almighty God to remove some of these things. It says we were entirely ready. It didn't say willing. It says ready. And being ready, my friends, that we must watch. Because, you see, it works like a dose of castor oil. Being willing isn't enough. You've got to be ready. Now, there is a story that is told, and I do believe it is true. Sometimes we say, well, look, these things, I have given up this, and I have given up that. And I simply cannot give up everything. This I must hold on to. You know, the story goes this way. There was a very rich young man that came to the master one day, and he said, Master, what must I do to be saved? And the good master said, sell all that you have and give it to the poor. And the story says that the young man went away very sorrowful. We find that happening to us at times. Why, many of us go away drunk because of that one little thing that we must hang on to, that we weren't entirely ready to give up. See? So therefore, when I say to myself, I'm a human being, I can't give this up, then I have a ready answer for me. Then, Holly Martin, if you're a human being, quit living like a dog. That's the answer. So I must stay entirely ready and humbly ask him to remove these shortcomings, too, that I have. Humbly ask him. Sometimes we feel that I have been praying and praying, and these things still keep coming back, cluttering up my mind. So therefore, we decide, at least I do, to offer them up each day to Almighty God because of my covenant with him. To channel these things. What are some of these things that I must channel? This awful pride of mine. How do I go about to channel that? That he will turn it into a good pride, that I don't go back to those old haunts and sit on the bar stool to flaunt it. See how I can stay sober? No. I take pride in what Almighty God has given me, a good pride. I ask Almighty God to channel this envy that is within me when I envy my fellow man, that I can do naught but emulate the good in him that I seek so hard to envy. Those are the things that I must ask him to channel for me. Ask him to channel this anger of mine, that I can only become angry with myself at the injustice that I do my fellow man. That if I keep on doing it, it's going to wind up right back where I started, full of remorse. So therefore, my friends, the time comes when I must make amends for some of these things. And it says that I make direct amends after I've got some of this other clutter out of the way. Sometimes, even today, how we like to walk around our meetings and we can't speak to the people. Amends. Amends for the past. And the amends that I do each day, that I must make each day. Oh, I don't like so-and-so. I simply can't talk to so-and-so. You know, so-and-so offended me. Isn't that wonderful? He offended me. You know, when I think of this thing, someone offended me to the point of where I don't know, I can't stand it much longer. I just think I'll have to take a drink. My feelings were hurt so bad. I remember this, my friends. I have no enemy on earth that would stoop low enough to humiliate me the way that I have humiliated myself. I have no friend in the world or enemy that's that low. No one can hurt me as badly as I have hurt myself. So you see, I can very easily get rid of that. And then we might say, oh, well, you know, I did make lovely amends this morning. You know, I went to church, you know, and I said a few prayers and I lit a candle. Now, I'm still all right, I'm not speaking to Bud, but, you know, I lit a few candles and I said a few prayers. My friends, it doesn't make any difference. You went over and set the church on fire. It said, made direct amends. Direct amends. Almighty God said, first make peace with your brother and then bring your gift to the altar. Did he not? Direct amends. You see, to me, this big book goes hand in hand with the greatest book ever written. To me, that it does. Now, in the tenth, where I must continue to do these things, why? So that complacency won't set in. You know, sometimes I always see the older member, you know, after he's been around 10 or 15 years, you know, well, he's got every excuse in the world. Well, he can't do 12-step anymore. His lumbago's bad or something like that, you know. And then furthermore, he has 15 years of sobriety, so let Joe do it. Or let Mary do it. You know, I sit back, you know, and draw my compensation. One of those things. Well, don't worry, my friends, you'll be duly compensated. Because action is the magic word. see. So I continue to take an inventory and promptly admit when I'm wrong for continued sobriety. Because I can't stand that old age complacency setting in. You know, the story goes. At one time, the master went through a very small town and he saw a beautiful fig tree. And it had beautiful green leaves on it, but it bore no fruit. And the master cursed it because it bore no fruit. That, my friends, can happen to me. I can still have a very beautiful sobriety for me. But action is a magic word. I must bear fruit. I must continue with my 12-step work. I must attend meetings. Those are the musts that I must make. They tell us when we come in here there are no musts, but I make my own musts. Because I know this, the day that I quit making my musts, John Barleycorn will make musts for me. And the musts that he can make, my friends, we pay a terrific price for. So I make them myself. I have that privilege, my free will, to beat him to the draw, to make my own musts each and every day. And then if I don't continue to take a personal inventory each and every day, first thing you know, that little key, I begin to lose that key again and lock myself in. And by locking myself in, first thing you know, you'll see me walking down the street or wobbling down the street, and I have but one lie to tell you when I lose that key, honestly. Oh, compulsion set in. I don't know what happened, you know, but compulsion set in. That's a beautiful story. There can be no compulsion without first consent of the will, say. And if I am still working on the second and third step, I have no will of my own because I've offered it up to Almighty God. And then, you know, as time goes on, if I don't continue to take that personal inventory, I get the I can'ts. Well, you know, I just simply can't, you know. I can't chair a meeting. I just don't know how. I can't, you know. After all, you know, I've did my part, and so I can't anymore. I've run out of ammunition. Well, a man doesn't know how far he can cast his shadow till he stands up. But he must stand up. That is for sure. And then I might say, well, you know, I'm afraid I might be criticized, and I just simply can't stand to be criticized. You know, if I have too many babies, you know, or I go to too many meetings, well, then, you know, people will criticize me. So what? Criticism. The good master says, let your light shine in order that men might see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. In order that men might see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. See? But you take no credit. For thine is the power and the glory. Because we're going to say that when we stand up today. For thine is the power and the glory. Didn't say anything about Holly Martin, did it? So therefore, criticism can't mean very much. As far as criticism goes, the way I look at it, if I would quit being so critical of other people, then I wouldn't worry too much about people criticizing me, would I? I don't think I would. You see, when I begin that envy, if I haven't cast it out and asking Almighty God to either remove it or channel it, I criticize because I'm looking at this particular person and seeing things there. But I must remember the same hand that wrote several thousand years ago writes today. If I only take my eyes off of the person that I'm criticizing and look at me or just drop my eyes, that same hand will write the thing in the dirt that I'm criticizing my fellow man for. You see, criticism, my friends, can only do one thing. When it doesn't destroy, the person that you want destroyed, but it destroys me. Because I see something there that I envy so bad I would like to emulate, but I don't know how. So I must drop my eyes and watch that hand write out the thing that I should be criticized for. Because if I don't, I will go back and complain to the bartender sooner or later. Don't say these things can't happen to me, because my friends, they can. See? The 11th, again, to me, is a very beautiful step. Where each day I have that privilege to renew these three gifts, my sanity, my sobriety, and my serenity. And again, declare my covenant with Almighty God as I understand Him. This I must do because I am now given a stewardship, which we call in this program sponsorship. But my friends, it is a stewardship. And one of these days, my divine maker will say to me, Holly Martin, what did you do with the stewardship that I give to you? How did you use it, or did you abuse it? How did I treat the new man or the woman or the new woman when they come through the door? What did I have to say about him? Well, you know, I don't want to get involved with him. I don't think they live so nice. At least he's not such a nice person, you know. After all, I don't want to, no one asked you to get involved. They asked you to carry the message, say. No wonder. Well, you know, after all, you know, I heard. You did? So therefore, that's all I'm asked to do is to carry the message. I am to help him with the program, and the program will help him solve his own problems. Well, you know, I think he or she is just too sick for me to bother with. Almighty God said, well, I have no need of a physician. Did he not? So then, you know one thing, if you are so well, then maybe when you get too well, you won't be needing any of us anymore, will we? So therefore, my friends, I take great pride in this stewardship. Again, I'm vowed to use pride here. To take great pride in the stewardship that Almighty God has entrusted me with. Practice these principles in all my affairs. That is indeed a great job. But I think the great Jewish Rabbi Hillel gave us that answer, how to practice these principles in all of our affairs, when he said this, whatever is hateful to you, do not unto your fellow man. This is the whole law. The rest is mere commentary. Thank you.